Hello and welcome to the HS2 Learning Legacy podcast. I'm your host, Rhian Owen. In this episode, we're going to look at projects that consider the railway's place in the environment and the impacts climate change might have on the railway. We'll see how railway assets have been designed from the start with climate change resilience in mind. We'll learn how granular modelling of weather conditions is allowing for safe, efficient construction, regardless of wind, rain, or scorching heat. And we'll discover how waste clay from tunnelling can be transformed into low-carbon concrete. The future we face is an uncertain one. As humans, we know that our activities are having an unprecedented impact on the climate. But we don't know just how extensive or disruptive these changes will be. Once operational, HS2's British-built bullet trains will provide zero-carbon journeys between the UK's two largest cities, Birmingham and London. Kay Hughes is Design Director for HS2. She says that a key part of the legacy of the railway will be what it tells us about how we can design for this future.
The aspirations of the programme at the outset to deliver a future-proofed railway around climate change at scale has massive lessons for the industry across all of the different areas, you know, from the urban design integration, from improving passenger experience, from minimizing environmental impact or integrating it cost effectively. I think all of those are big lessons that we are working to deliver in HS2, and I think there are really good examples of where we're delivering better and well that are coming through the learning legacy.
HS2 is one of the UK's first pieces of major infrastructure that has climate resilience embedded at every step of the process.
The difference between HS2 and legacy infrastructure is that we've been able to build in climate resilience at every step of the process, planning, designing and constructing the railway, as well as integrating this work into plans for future operations and maintenance.
Alison Walker is Climate Change Manager at HS2 and author of the Delivering a Climate Change Resilient Railway Learning Legacy paper.
So HS2 is designed to be resilient to a 1 in 1,000 year event. And our drainage infrastructure is also designed to cope with a 1 in 100 year plus climate change. So this will protect the railway infrastructure from floodwater, ensuring that we'll remain operational or we can restart without undue delay.
Just to explain what we mean by a 1 in 1,000 year event. So that's a flood event that's magnitude would statistically speaking have a 1 in 1,000 chance of occurring in any given year. So as Alison said, it's a higher bar than most other infrastructure projects.
Dr. Rachel Allison is a climate change specialist at HS2. HS2's environmental policy set out from the start that the network had to be climate resilient in the long term, and it specified many climate change related requirements and standards for the design and construction process.
So underneath that, we have a bespoke climate change adaptation and resilience technical standard that provides all of HS2's requirements and associated guidance for managing climate change resilience. That includes design, construction and operation of HS2. And the requirements set out in that technical standard are really important because they set the basis for all our decision making. Within that, we talk about the climate change design impact assessment, or CCDIA, for assessing the resilience of standards and our future designs. We provide the climate change design impact assessment to our contractors, and then they use that to assess their risks, and they provide us with a climate change adaptation and resilience report that we then assure.
By receiving an impact assessment, contractors understand exactly what is required, and their resilience report allows HS2 to know that their resilience standards are being met. One example of HS2's commitment to high standards is the station's BREEAM certifications. BREEAM is the Building Research Establishment Environmental Assessment Method. It scores a building from pass to outstanding based on a number of different environmental and sustainability criteria. For all HS2 stations, achieving the BREEAM credit for climate adaptation is mandatory. This has led to some creative innovations at stations like Interchange in the West Midlands.
In terms of climate resilience, some of the adaptation measures that they've implemented at Interchange include the innovative roof design, and this captures and reuses rainwater to reduce the mains water demands. So during times of drought, we'll be much more resilient. And also their landscaping features that will be implemented around the station. These use sustainable drainage systems to reduce the burden on our surface water during periods of intense rainfall, and then naturally irrigate the planted areas during periods of drought.
What has been key to ensuring the delivery of climate resilience is making the process clear and consistent for the design and construction contractors. That will be a valuable legacy for the industry, says Kay.
The lessons learned from those projects are, how do we respond to the effects of climate change and making greener buildings that are lower carbon? So the lessons we have from those is, one, at the outset and during the design stages, a certain amount of kind of fluidity in the design to get all of those different constraints resolved into a design. And then the other part of that is the kind of objective of having a sustainable outcome, which is low carbon, so using timber in the roof, using daylight within the building, and then also using the grey water from the roof and using that in the balancing ponds nearby. You know, it's a perfect learning legacy, particularly for what you would call parkway stations, how they can be done in an environmentally way.
But it's not just the stations. Assets of all types up and down the line need in some form or another to be able to face the changing climate and avoid the kind of problems that are caused for the existing conventional railway by extreme weather events.
So in HS2, we've got a lot of earthworks, we've got embankments and we've got cuttings, and these are all going to be susceptible to climate change, and their stability is obviously absolutely critical. So what we've done is we've tried to combine the different climate variables that are going to be impacting these variables, and then made sure that our earthwork designers have adopted a cautious design approach.
But being climate change resilient is not just about preparing for the worst and hoping to survive it. In fact, the Climate Resilient Railway Learning Legacy paper lays out what Alison calls the four R's of resiliency.
The resistance, that concerns physical protection against climate change. Reliability, that's the capacity of the infrastructure or asset to maintain operations under a range of conditions. Redundancy is the adaptability of the infrastructure system or network, and response and recovery, which is the ability to recover from a disruption to return to functionality.
The final R, or two R's, for response and recovery are particularly important. Predicting what climate change will bring in 100 years is nearly impossible. Therefore, HS2 is being careful when using future projections.
No one climate model is going to be perfect. These are projections, they're not predictions. So we have to be cognizant of that and make sure that we're not putting all our design scenarios into one model that may or may not happen. So we've chosen ones that are conservative. So yeah, trying to make sure that the climate projection we use is realistic, but not too excessive.
And if something does happen, or when it becomes time for an asset to be replaced, HS2 will have the ability to improve the resilience again.
While the railway is designed to be built over 120-year lifespan, not all components of it will have that full length of lifespan. So where we are doing asset replacement cycles as part of the regular use, adaptive management will allow us to look at the climate projections at the time that they're replaced and make adjusted decisions accordingly. So it might not be replacing like for like. There might be a better solution in the future.
Climate adaptation has never been so front and centre of a major infrastructure project before. The results are individual assets and an overall train system that will be fit to face climate change challenges. From aerodynamic bridge design to water-efficient stations, every single asset along the route has had resiliency considered and built in. But it's not the individual design elements or innovations that make HS2's climate resilience special. It's the commitments, clear standards, and collaboration across the project that has allowed them to deliver an asset fit for the entire 21st century.
I think the main reason why we've been able to do so much is that we've had fantastic colleagues to work with at HS2, set up a climate change adaptation and resilience focus group that's been really helpful. So that, I think, is a really good piece of learning from the work that we've been doing. No one person can do this job. It has to be collaborative across the organisation.
I think it's just that a project of this scale has so many different aspects and things that need to be thought about. And I think, as Alison said, no one person can do all of this. So having it all set out makes sure that it is considered and it doesn't get lost in the scale of the project, because that would be a real loss to the project. It's strengthened by how many experts and how many different elements are being considered across the project to make it the best railway it can be.
Alison and Rachel's paper looked at the broad challenges of climate resilience. Their work considers the long-term impact of climate on a project that is designed for a 120-year lifespan. But we are already seeing the effects of climate change today. Extreme weather events like rain, heat, and high winds can all disrupt construction work. And as climate change takes hold, all of these are becoming more frequent. Nick Podevin is an innovation manager for Align, working on the Section 1 of HS2 that includes the Colne Valley Viaduct and Chiltern Tunnel. He worked with Alison and Rachel on their paper. For the Colne Valley Viaduct, Align is using a bridge launch girder. This sits on top of the partially built viaduct. It picks up heavy concrete sections and positions them for attachment to the viaduct.
It's a huge challenge about winding off events for lifting, for cranes and stuff. So straight away, that was something that was a laser focus for us. And that was really the starting point for me as the innovation manager to look for some ways to optimise for weather and really understand the weather forecasting better. Each segment is 140 tonnes-ish, and the wind speed window is fairly small. And it's not just the speed of the wind, but you're looking for a window. Once you start lifting that segment underneath the launch girder, moving it out into position and lowering it down into its final resting place, you need the wind speed to be low enough for that whole period of time.
When you're slowly raising heavy concrete sections like this, wind is a real threat. But other construction activities around the girder are also impacted by weather.
Yeah, so we use some multi-wheeled vehicles. So we're doing on-site manufacturing. So all our segments are cast at the South Portal site. And then they're moved by those vehicles, sort of basically like a low loader from the site down from the precast site down to where the launch girder is. So again, there are other weather implications of that. So the haul road, particularly in winter, is what's the quality of that haul road? Traditionally, these sort of temporary roads degrade through the heavy rainfall.
Rain is also a threat to the finish of the viaduct.
To do the waterproofing, it needs to be dry to do it properly. So we're not looking at wind speed anymore. We're looking at what's the likelihood of a rain event, how much rain and for how long.
The summer presents its own challenges, with the UK now seeing extreme high temperatures.
2022 is the first year we saw, above 40 degree heat. All of a sudden, it's not an environment we're used to working in, and safety comes first, and sites are getting stopped in extreme weather.
To understand all of these challenges, Nick needed more accurate information.
Traditionally, go to the Met Office and you find the local weather station nearest you to get your weather data, and that gives you a certain level of confidence and detail. But then you have to start asking yourself a few questions about the data you're getting from the Met Office, which is very good, but it is a general weather Met Office station. So for us, we wanted to be much more specific to the operations we're doing. And so that led us down the route of looking for something where we had weather stations on site collecting the real weather data. And that then led us, well, how do you then use that in a more, with better insight? So that led us down the route of finding a small startup company that used artificial intelligence and machine learning, and they were able to bring in weather models, so global weather models looking at historical patterns, and then bring in the sort of UK weather models, and then bring in the site specific weather data, enabling us to get a very site specific forecast for 10 days ahead in detail, and then also up to 2 years ahead in more general detail.
The company Nick describes is called MetSwift. It was able to make more accurate predictions around when adverse weather events would occur and for how long. That meant the launch girder could work safely without excess downtime. MetSwift's model also takes into account site-specific conditions. The Colne Valley naturally funnels wind, so gusts may occur on site even when overall wind speeds for the Met Office area are acceptable. But the model can be used for more long-term forecasting.
So the 10-day ahead capability is kind of like an app on your phone where you are looking, and at any time you're going onto the system, it's bringing all that weather data to you, to your fingertips. And it depends on what operation you're doing. So as I described there, some teams might be more interested in the rain events, others more in the wind events. So you can optimize by just looking at one of those weather parameters and also setting your weather limits. And then there's the longer term forecasts where you're not getting hour by hour type information, but you're getting more a day by day view of the world of these different parameters. So that's more helpful to our planning teams. It's helpful to the teams when they're looking to budget for the next 6 to 12 months ahead.
By tracking site-specific weather conditions and making forecasts using MetSwift's modelling, Nick and Aline have been able to point the way to a brighter future. Alison and Rachel's work helps us understand how to build an asset that is ready for 120 years of unpredictable climate change. Nick's work with MetSwift shows how, as adverse weather events become more frequent, we can continue to work on site safely and efficiently. But how do we limit the impact of climate change? One way the construction industry can do this is by replacing Portland lime cement in concrete.
Concrete is the second most consumed material on Earth after water, to give it context, and we are in dire need of solutions to decarbonize it, and decarbonize it fast.
Overall, Athena Papacosta, SCS Sustainability and Carbon Lead, explains the built environment accounts for around 40% of all climate-changing emissions. Much of this is from the impact of steel and concrete production. Cement, the key binder material within concrete production, produces greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change in two ways: through the heat required to turn limestone into cement, and the release of carbon dioxide during this chemical process. Athena and her colleagues have been studying how London clay extracted from HS2 tunnelling could be used in construction. This would cut transport emissions related to removing the material. If the excavated London clay could be turned to be used locally in concrete, it could also reduce the embodied carbon emissions. They worked on this through the REAL project, a feasibility study led by SCS and AREP to look into innovative ways to use the otherwise waste excavated clay as a construction resource.
We initially were looking at two primary potential outcomes, one of which was lightweight aggregate, but from expanded clay, and the other one that gained more and more traction due to its potential in all shapes and forms, including both technical potential and sustainability benefits, was the supplementary cementitious material from calcined clay.
Before they got their hands dirty working directly with the excavated clay, Athena and her colleagues explored the existing research and performed some lab tests.
So the first step was to look at what was out there in terms of literature. It was to analyze samples from different locations of calcined clay to examine its variability and its properties, so on and so forth, and run, let's say, a first round of testing on these samples with regards to their suitability for these particular two applications, the expanded clay and the calcined clay.
Dr. Fragoulis Kanavaris is concrete materials lead for AREP. He worked on the project with Athena. The team saw that there was some potential for the waste clay to be used in expanded form as aggregate. But the biggest win would come from using it as a replacement for cement.
We started together thinking about how to manage the waste that is going to be generated and is currently generated as part of the tunneling operations of within the London tunnels. And we came up with this exciting idea. And we are seeing now that more and more industry bodies are getting interested in this kind of application of waste clay as a supplementary cementitious material.
The product the team focused on is known as calcined clay. Like cement, it is heated in a kiln, but the raw material and the chemical reaction taking place during production is different and does not release CO2, and the temperatures required are lower than those for cement. Apostolos Sormalekas is a materials engineer for SCS and worked on the project coordinating the concrete trials at the SCS labs.
I was mainly involved in getting the calcined clay and doing the lab trials, developing the concrete mixes for the lab. As a contractor, we don't get too much hands-on experience on new products coming up. We would normally rely on the supply chain to do that, and we attend trials. But this was a hands-on experience, and it was great to do. It's amazing to lead the industry into this, and now we see more contractors, more supply chain going into the calcined clay works. And you know, HS2 gave us this opportunity to do that. It's a project that can allow that, and the legacy coming out of that is massive.
Tom Berhersey supported the project from the HS2 side. The HS2 tunnelling works under London that SCS and other HS2 contractors are undertaking would provide a vast amount of material for the team to work with.
Our contract is unlike any of the others on HS2 because I think if you look at the phase one hybrid build design, there's 130 megatons of excavated material waste across phase one. So we've got to be really innovative on what we do with our waste because we simply can't reuse it under other kind of materials management plans or other kind of permitting regimes. We've got to work out what we're going to do with it. So anything we can divest from going to landfill or being a proper waste product is a win in my book and a massive sustainability score.
The idea of using clay in concrete is not a new one, Frag explains.
Well, how did we have that eureka moment? And we have to acknowledge that when we were dealing with the problem of, you know, managing the waste and what we can do with the clay waste, the inspiration came from calcined clays being used back in the 60s and 50s in the construction of massive dams in Brazil in particular. And back then they were using low quality clays because the concrete that has been used in dams and was being used in dams at the time didn't need to be very high quality, very high strength. We knew back in 2018 that this was possible back then. They did it back then. They extracted clay, low grade, low quality clay, and they calcined it and they used it in concrete to produce medium to low strength concrete.
It's important to emphasize that as well as finding a use for this waste excavated material, calcining clay offers a double win in climate change terms.
Portland cement is manufactured through heating up limestone and clay and other minor constituents to approximately 1400 degrees Celsius for an hour and a half. So we're following a similar thermal treatment process, but with half of the temperature and half of the duration required for calcination. So calcined clay encompasses about one third of the embodied carbon of Portland cement.
The potential to make use of clay is well established, but would the London clay from these tunnels have the characteristics the teams needed to use in concrete?
So the key points that need to be understood is whether the clay contains any contaminants that could be potentially detrimental to the durability or the behavior of the concrete overall, whether the clay contains any contaminants that could impair its reactivity. And by reactivity, we mean how well is it going to perform in concrete as a cementitious material.
They then moved on to consider the process of calcination and the performance of the calcined London clay as a cement replacement.
Because we want to use as lower temperature as practically possible and for as short time as practically possible to minimize the energy consumption. And then once we obtain the different samples of calcined London clay material, we carried out tests on its reactivity and its potential use using concrete, using microstructural techniques and thermal processing techniques.
The team showed that the clay extracted was of a consistent quality. In the lab, they demonstrated concrete made with it would perform as required. But can the project be scaled up?
It can be a, let's say, gradual process of increasing, let's say, the size of the plants. But that is exactly, let's say, the crossroads at which we sit at the minute, because the next step will need to be commercialization.
We showed you can produce a concrete mix that can actually be used in the works. Yeah. Now, there needs to be a little bit of a mindset change in the industry in general, because obviously it's something new. But if you start the process and you show that this can be done, yeah, it looks like normal concrete. Yeah, the color might be a little bit different, but it reacts as concrete. It hardens the way it does whatever you want it to do on site. Then more people will look into it and say, okay, yeah, this works there. Therefore, I'm more happy to go ahead and use it on our projects. And this is a good thing that we can do with this, changing the mentality of how people see what we have been doing for the last 20, 30 years and what we're going to be doing in the next 20 years.
The team's work show that this could be possible in London with industry support. There's no shortage of material that could be used in this way.
So when it comes to London clay, I think really we're almost putting our line in the sand, as it were. The government's going to have Crossrail 2, it can pick up off the shelf. There's going to be other tunnelling projects in London. If you think about the depth of London clay, I think some areas 150 metres deep, normally deeper towards the east end of the basin. As densely populated as the tube map looks when you look at it, there's plenty of space down there, and that space is going to produce London clay as a rising.
The paper sets the groundwork for London clay to be used as a cement replacement for concrete production. It has a wider legacy, though, that could see benefits across the construction industry.
We also contributed to a scientific breakthrough showing the engineering and scientific community that is possible to use waste clays that are low quality for production of calcined clays in concrete. And we are seeing now, because I'm monitoring how research evolves over the past years in that field, we are seeing far more research being conducted in lower grade or lower quality waste clays than it was a couple of years ago or 3 years ago.
Would like to see ourselves paving the way that it is a product that of course needs work, but it looks good and it looks like it can be trusted because of the results we are producing.
In this episode, we've seen how we can design a railway and other assets to withstand the effects of climate change. We've seen how construction can be carried out safely and efficiently, even as adverse weather conditions become more frequent and more intense. And we've learned that the waste materials of tunnelling in London, along with clay from other sources, could one day be used to replace carbon-emitting constituents of concrete. In our next episode, we'll learn about some of the ways in which the railway is helping improve the health, safety and well-being of its staff and customers. I've been your host, Rhian Owen. Thanks to our guests, Kay Hughes, Alison Walker, Dr. Rachel Allison, Nick Podevan, Athena Papacosta, Dr. Fragoulis Canavaris, Apostolos Soumalekas, and Tom Berhersey. You can get more details on all the topics featured in the series by taking a look at the HS2 Learning Legacy website. We have provided links in the episode description. To learn more about HS2, go to hs2.org.uk or follow us on social media at HS2LTD.